If you turn back with me into the passage that we read in Genesis chapter 4. This evening, we're going to look again at the story of Cain. I was here in January, obviously I'm here every week, but I was preaching here in January in the morning, and we looked at Genesis chapter 4, and we looked at the first 16 verses. And we considered, didn't we, a lesson that sin was a fast-acting and deadly poison. And in Cain's experience, it caused him very quickly to go from a worshipper at the altar to ultimately and finally walking out on God altogether. But sin isn't quite that simple. Sin isn't just a path to destruction and ruin. It's not just a poison that kills. Perhaps that's how we often consider it. We think of it as a thing that's a destructive thing. Something that kills. It actually has in Scripture many other attributes. And tonight we're going to consider one more of those attributes as experienced by Cain and its application. We'll first of all look at the narrative and we'll step through that, focusing on the latter half. We'll step through the beginning very quickly. We'll then draw a lesson and then we'll apply it in two different ways. So very quickly then, into our narrative. What's going on in Genesis chapter 4? What's going on with Cain? As I said, we'll go through the first 16 verses very quickly. Well, Cain and Abel, they go to worship at the beginning, don't they? They go to the altar. They have two different sacrifices. Abel takes a sheep, a lamb, the first fruits, and Cain takes of his own labours of the ground. He takes vegetables. And in verse 5, after the sacrifice of Abel is conspicuously accepted by God and Cain's is rejected, Cain becomes very angry. He is offended at God's rejection. Sin first manifests itself on the scene. In verses 6 and 7, God comes to Cain. He sees what's going on and he calls for him to repent, doesn't he? And he warns him that sin lies at the door. Sin wants to have you, Cain. Well, in verse 8, after Cain has rejected God's warning, sin becomes bigger sin. He murders his brother in the field. God again comes to him in verse 9 and asks him to repent. But again, Cain refuses. And now justice must be done. God judges Cain for his sin. And in verses 13 and 14, Cain realizes that every dimension he dies. He's being thrown out of God's presence. God curses the ground below him. And he also knows that everyone around him is going to want to kill him. So every dimension, north, south, east and west, he dies and he cries for mercy. And in verse 15, God gives him mercy. But his response to mercy in verse 16 is to walk out on God forever. And he never comes back. An ever-increasing descent into wickedness and going away from God until the crowning decision in verse 16. A worshipper at the altar, but the mask of religion is horrifically torn off in 11 verses. And it reveals that there's just a monster underneath. But what happens to Cain? Although many of you are probably very familiar with the story of Cain and Abel, when you get to the end of verse 16, what would you expect to happen? What would you expect the ending of Cain to be after everything that's happened? Would you expect him to die in the wilderness, a worn-out wreck? After all, he's walked out on God, he's murdered his brother. Surely that's the end of Cain. Surely that's the idea. Does someone eventually take the risk to kill him? Does someone in the end of his family hate what he's done so much that they say, I don't care that God will reward me seven times worse. I hate Cain that much, I take the risk. Is he forsaken by all? Is he an outcast? Does he become a living symbol of emptiness and futility at walking out on God? Destitute? No. No, he doesn't. Verses 17 and 18, Cain actually goes and builds a city. And he has a family. He has sons and daughters. He has many generations. We have up to Lamech listed, so that's six generations from Cain. But most likely you had three or four more generations after that. Lamech is there for a reason, not because that's the end of the chronology. So he has many sons and daughters, generations after him. And if we continue reading through Genesis 6, we get an idea of scale, because it tells us that the whole world is full of people. So the world is it's not the case of filled with people when there's no space left. It wouldn't have been as full as it is today. But people were everywhere. It wasn't like a tiny little section of people living in a tiny village, as all Cain had. No, the world was full of people. He's also a proud father. People familiar with Proverbs will know Proverbs 17 verse 6 says this, says that grandchildren are the crown of the aged, and the glory of children is their father's. Well, Cain is a proud father, and he fulfills Proverbs 17 verse 6, because when he builds his city, who does he name it after? His son, Enoch. He builds a lasting monument. This is Cain's city, this is my city, and I'm going to name it after my son. It's the city of my son, the city for my son. And we understand this because if we're parents, why do we cheer on our son at football? Why do we strive our children to succeed? Why at Christmas, if the neighbours buy something for one child, our child asks for the same thing and people take out loans to try and afford it? Why do people do that? Why is there that competition? Because parents see that their glory and reputation is tied into their children. People judge them as parents and as people by their children and their success and what they have. And so it is with Cain. He's a proud father of Enoch. And his city isn't dry and empty. It's not a desert existence. It's one that becomes full of life and colour, culture, diversity. You've got music, the arts, husbandry, crafts, all listed in there as his descendants create them and make them. And it's not a borrowed wealth. It's not like let's try and think of a good example. It's not like a bit like Dubai, I suppose, where there's lots of money and investment going in and they're buying all the new things in from other places. They're actually the pioneers. It says they're the fathers of. So they're the industrious ones. They're the bright ones, it would seem, the inventors. Cain's city, family, are a driving force in innovation. Prosperity, they're one step ahead. It's a city of the first world. It's the London, New York, Paris, Seoul, Beijing of its time. Who wouldn't want to live in Cain's city? So what's happened to Cain the monster? What's happened since verse 16? What's happened to the man who murdered his brother? Let's meet one of the dwellers of this city. Let's meet one of Cain's descendants and see what he's like. And his name is Lamech. This is his boast in verses 23 and 24 to his wives. We'll read it again. Ada and Zillah, hear my voice. Wives of Lamech, listen to my speech. For I have killed a man for wounding me, even a young man for hurting me. If Cain be avenged sevenfold, then Lamech 77-fold. Lamech's boast, his glory, his declaration to his wives is his guilt. If Cain's crime was so bad that God had to protect him with a sevenfold judgment, well, look at the things I have done, Ada and Zillah. God will have to put a punishment of extremities on the person who tries to take against me. My crimes are so severe that God will need an extra special judgment to preserve my life. It's a bit like two criminals boasting and one saying, oh, I got 5 years from the judge, and the other one going, well, I got 50 years. That's the inhabitants of Cain's city. So for all its pomp, all its wonder and greatness, all its being the first, the pioneers, the first city, as in the most prominent city of its time, it's a pillow of nettles. Or could put it another way, it's deadly poison, but it smells good. If you feel emotionally hurt and you've fallen out with someone, you run to someone else who you can trust to discuss it through. Hoping that they'll make you feel a little bit better, give you some comfort. None of those things mean the problem's gone away. The relationship may still be affected. The work is still there, even though you're on holiday. And the headache, the pain is a symptom of the headache. The headache's caused by something else. The problem's still there. But the pain is gone. Or at least it's eased to a degree. Well, in Genesis 4, we see Cain, and he descends fast, and he descends really far. Who would have thought the worshipper would become a murderer, who would become someone who walks out on God forever in so short a time? But Genesis 4 also tells us where Cain seeks his refuge. We also see how sin, the sin that ruled him all the way to verse 16, kept him ensnared. How it deadened him to his consequences. How it became an anesthetic as well as something that destroys. There's three things I want to look at about Cain's situation. How sin numbed Cain to his real situation. Firstly, a city. First thing was a city. And we're going to compare the judgments to what Cain actually does in verses 17 and onwards. Well, in verse 13 and 14, which are the judgments in chapter 4 against Cain, Cain says to God, "You've made me a fugitive and a vagabond. You've made me a man on the run, a man with no place to rest, a man with no place to call home." So what does Cain do? He leaves where he was. He travels east of the side of Eden to a place called the land of Nod, the land of wandering. Reflects what he was like spiritually at the time. It's where no one resides. And he builds for himself a permanent residence. A city. A permanent dwelling for a man who had no place to rest. A man far from God. And he names it after his son Enoch. Excuse me. The name Enoch means dedicated. And names are important in the Bible. It's a city that Cain has built with his hands. It's his work. And he calls it dedication or dedicated. It's named after his son. Yes, parents see glory through their children. But there might be something else in it. Because it might be that the city to Cain has become a little bit more than a city. Because on the one hand, he has Enoch, the son of his flesh. And on the other hand, he has a city, the son of his hands. Something he's built out of his own hard work. His dwelling, it's his great work. His dedication. Record Breakers in the 90s, if anyone used to watch it all those years ago. It had a theme tune, I won't hum it or sing it, but it had these lyrics. It was, "Dedication is what you need. If you want to be the best and you want to beat the rest, dedication is what you need." Cain offered the fruit of his ground, fruit of the ground, as his worship to God, a farmer, and he offered his labours. Well, it's now the worship he offers himself. This is for his own reward. In place of his rejection of God, to replace being a fugitive with nowhere to live, or he walks far from God and builds a permanent place there instead. A man on the run builds a permanent dwelling. Well, secondly, a family. Verses 13 and 14, he says to God, he complains to God that you've driven me from yourself, from God, and from other people. Not only a man with no place to live, a man on the run, I'm also a man all alone in fear for my life. We're introduced to the fact that Cain has a wife, so in terms of being alone, he's not completely and utterly alone. He has a wife. And with the city, he begins to fill it with family. And they become, as we see with Lamech, people after his own likeness. A man with no one and no relationship with God has a family to replace his isolation. It may seem a little odd to think of Cain having a family to replace his isolation. And you may be thinking, well, surely a family happens naturally, John. He has a wife and he lived for a very long time. Shouldn't we expect that? Yes, we should. But the importance isn't that Cain has his own family, but that he never reconciles with the one that he's left behind. He does nothing to restore the original relationship. He wanders far from God and cuts them off. He's a man under a curse, and he's still an unrepentant sinner. He's still against God, and he's in flight from his brothers and sisters. And in this situation, he has a family of his own. Doesn't reconcile. He replaces what he's lost. Well, thirdly, a new glory. Again, in verses 13 and 14, he says to God that you've made the ground my enemy. It's the place of my survival and sustenance. I'm a farmer. If you're going to curse anything, don't curse the very thing that survives me. It's made him a beggar. It's made him unable to prosper. Or so it would seem. So Cain, with his family, in his city, they work an unyielding ground into a city of culture, life, and industry. Wealth, glory, riches replace his poverty and emptiness. I hope no one in London will be offended by this illustration. But why do we talk of Knightsbridge, Kensington, and Mayfair in one breath? And no offence to those who live there. Why do we talk of Peckham, Archway, and Hackney in perhaps another breath? Because we assess people, don't we, by their success. Their glory in this world is so tied up in what they have and how much they earn. The size of their house, what car they drive. Reputation for wealth, luxury, celebrity, status, it's this world's glory. Cain has walked out on God. He's left that behind. And his leaving has made him a beggar. Poverty and emptiness appears to be his lot. But as he's walked out on the God who made him, he seeks to make a man of himself. He makes a new glory, a new pursuit, a new prestige, a new heart's desire. A self-made man. It's his city. Do you see the threefold painkiller that sin applies? That it caused him to pursue. We draw the intention to his judgments intentionally because he lost a kingdom. So he goes and builds another. He leaves one dwelling and he builds another far from God. He loses one relationship and he builds another one. He loses one crown and honour with God, who he leaves far behind. And so he lives after a different honour. The hatred, death and suffering is still there. Lamech still murders for a wound, and he still boasts in his wickedness. You could argue that Lamech is far worse than Cain in his arrogance at his own sin. But perhaps this is the crux of it. Perhaps this is the thing with Cain's city, and maybe you thought this, or certainly saw this as you read through. Sometimes things can seem so bad, can't they? But they can certainly be a lot more bearable when you've got a kingdom, a family, and a wealth to call your own. It's the numbing effect of sin. It destroys. It's destroyed Cain. But he had a city and a family. An industrious one at that. It destroyed and gave him a smile. It kills. It can often make you feel so good. This is God's assessment of the earth several generations later. You can read it in Genesis chapter 6. He says, I have determined to make an end of all flesh, for the earth is filled with violence through them. A world of Cain's city, filled with violence, but also wealth and music and arts and science. I wonder if you're being numbed to destruction. L'Oreal, the global cosmetics company, they used to have this slogan, used to be on television a lot, I can't think of any adverts with it now, but it was always the because you're worth it. For your women, washing your hair, it was always the sort of L'Oreal products. In many ways, that could sort of sum up this generation. That's no offence to L'Oreal. But it could be used to sum up the message of this world, couldn't it? We're worth it. L'Oreal's marketing campaign is considered to be extremely successful, unusually successful. And I think it's the biggest cosmetics company in the world. Well, Sin's marketing campaign is also very successful. The Bible tells us that Cain's situation is our situation. We've walked out on God. We've chosen the path of sin and rebellion against God, that we've deserted him. We're under his judgment. We've lost our place in his kingdom with him. We've lost our relationship to him. We've lost our glory and honor. And like Cain, our destination is in the hands of an angry God. And an angry God must punish sin. And sin doesn't actually just alienate us, does it? It doesn't just destroy us. It doesn't just ruin us. It has a double action. Because it numbs you to its symptoms. It twists us and deceives us to the damage that it causes. Some people compare sin to a cancer. But the picture isn't quite complete, or at least it's not if I understand cancer correctly. Because cancer is a disease which can cause much pain and suffering. And as it progresses, people go on to more and more strong treatments, aggressive treatments. Some of those are damaging in and of themselves. But as cancer progresses, you take more and more pain relief. Because cancer destroys. But if sin was a cancer, it would be one that whilst it destroys you, it would flood your body with pain relief. It would give you moments of euphoria. Because it would seek any means to prevent you from actually trying to treat it. I wonder if you're being numbed by it. It's a Sunday evening, and sin's been mentioned yet again. Preachers talk about the wickedness of man, the anger of God, and the need for salvation. And do you say to yourself, who needs God? Where is the judgment? That's the thing with Cain, isn't it? Where did the judgment go? Cain's city seems to be industrious and thriving. Where's the judgment of verses 13 and 14? And maybe you're thinking the same thing. We keep hearing of judgment, but where is it? Where's the problem? Nobody's perfect. We all make mistakes. We understand that. But hell? Hell's a bit extreme. Maybe you're someone a bit different to that, and you look around and you see the beauty of the sunset. And you see the excitement of snow when snow starts falling, everyone at work, or at least everyone at my work anyway, you look out the window, oh, it's snowing, and always see if it's laying down and whether we can go home early. You've got children who run out with their sledges and listen to the radio hoping the school's closed because of some heating issue. You've got the thrill of water sports if you're someone that's going to the Mediterranean and it's the sun and it's the sea and you can hire a jet ski and sort of go out for a while. Maybe you're someone who's got quite a bit of money and money's comfortable. Let's not pretend that it isn't. Remember a few weeks ago, Gerard preached on Ecclesiastes, and there's something very interesting that Solomon says in Ecclesiastes. He says that some things solve some problems, and then he says, but money has the tendency to solve all problems, doesn't it? There's truth in that, isn't there? We'll say our money doesn't make us happy, but we'll certainly say money would certainly get rid of some of the things that make me sad. Perhaps that's what you feel like. This wonderful world that we have. Where's this horrible sin that you talk of? Maybe again you're someone a little bit different, and this time you're a parent, busy at home with children. They're growing up. There's so many needs and concerns there, and also you've got, because you're the parents with children at home, that means your parents are perhaps, you know, slightly older. Perhaps they're reaching the sort of 75. 80 mark, and they're beginning to be sort of people who now need care themselves. You're having to visit them more often, and you've got grandchildren to bring to them. There's just so many things, and there's work as well, and you've got this age where work demands a lot of you. You're experienced. People want a lot more of your time to be involved in a lot more of things. There's just so many other things to deal with. This world is just so busy. I'll think about Jesus later. There's just so many things to do. Or perhaps you're someone who ums and ahs about the gospel. Who ums and ahs about Jesus. You hear the come to Jesus Christ, repent and live. And you do genuinely feel a little bit exposed. You do feel like there's a truth in there. And something gets you. Gets under your skin. You do feel the word speaking to you, and maybe you've been on a Christian camp, young people's camp, or maybe you've been here on Sundays quite regularly, and you actually do feel, you know, sometimes you may have even made a false profession because it so affected you at the time. You sort of actually say, I think I'm a Christian. But as soon as you sort of walk out of the chapel door, and the chapel door has an amazing way of doing this, suddenly the urgency is gone. Suddenly when you see the rest of the world, and suddenly Monday morning sets upon you, well, you did feel exposed, but now that wound is well and truly closed, and the felt need is gone. All that's left is Monday morning. It's the numbing effect of sin. Sin tells us not to worry. It tells us, don't look any further. Don't try and seek after God. Seek after other things. Stay far away. Enjoy the things you have now. If you want money, get more of it. Come to Cain City. Enjoy what he has. Love holidays? Take some. You can have as many as you like. You've lasted until now. Why do you think there's an angry God at all? It's interesting, isn't it, with Lamech's proclamation. He's almost mocking the judgment of God. God said, Cain is so evil. Well, I'm doing really evil things. Nothing seems to be happening to me. It's almost an open mocking. I've lasted so long. Is there really an angry God at all? It says there's so many other immediate concerns, like your family. Family is a very legitimate concern, but is it the concern that excuses the ultimate concern, which is your spiritual destiny? Let God come later. You're a young person. And certainly never make a snap decision. Take your time, particularly after watching the telly. Think about it later. Dwell on it for several decades, maybe. Maybe then, that's the time to consider your standing with God. It says build a city. It says make friends, have a family. It says make a name for yourself, a place for yourself here. It offers a world of pleasures. Come and spend your life here. When I was 17, I planned to leave God behind, finally and fully. I've been brought up in a Christian home. And I looked for the day that I turned 18. Of course, I didn't tell anybody this at the time. But I was waiting for the day of 18 because it would be university. I'd be a couple of hours' drive away. People I didn't know. I could just throw the shackles off that I'd been brought up with. At least that was my intention at the time. And just as I was reaching that sort of that point of freedom, God spoke to me through a youth group talk. And this is what he said. He said to me, all those things that you want, and I have big aspirations of what I would like of life. He said, all the things that you want, and you can't wait to live for, can't wait to get out of the house and get off to uni and be your own man and leave all that rubbishy stuff that you think of behind. Well, one day, sooner than you think, that will go, and you'll die. Do you want to perish with them? Want to go to your grave with those things? Or do you want to live? Do you want to have real life in Jesus Christ? I often get to walk around military bases as part of my work. Many of them, as you would expect, have plaques or epitaphs to fallen soldiers who've died to serve their country. And I was walking around one particular military base, and I was reading this sort of monument around one of their buildings. And I was looking down the list of names of men and women, and they've given their lives for this country. They died for this world. And I remember looking down the list, and I was thinking to myself, I really hope, that though they've died for this world, they trusted in Christ and his death to secure them for the next one. It's an honour to have a memorial in this world. But it's essential that you enter into God's home in the next. Don't succumb to the anesthetic of sin. Don't be numbed into an eternal death. Let the pinch of the gospel hurt and obey it. It says you're a sinner. It says you will be judged. It says that God is a place of hell. God has a place called hell. It's where rubbish burns and it burns forever. It says that's a place where you are going if you do not come to Christ. It says there is only one way. It's not many. It's only one. A wonderful and gracious Jesus Christ. Let that hurt. Don't let sin numb you to it. And trust in him. But sin doesn't just affect non-Christians. If you're a Christian tonight, it'll also affect you. It doesn't numb you to death, but it can certainly numb you to paralysis. Because sin is so good, isn't it, as Christians, to get us to only go so far with dealing with it and making us look at this world and put this world ahead of the next one, of whispering in our ear and encouraging us to build our city, our home here. Make our sphere of relationships unchristian. Seek after this world's pleasures and glories. Sin doesn't destroy you. It can't if you're Christ's. But it can certainly anesthetize your Christian life and your relationship with God. It can certainly leave you a paralyzed lump of a living soul, if I can put it like that. What does it mean then, if we're Christian, what does it mean to build a home here? To build a city? Well, a home is where you feel most comfortable, isn't it? It's a place you desire to be. It's a place where you see yourself belonging. It's your centre of gravity. Everything else rotates around it. If you were to draw a map, or to do Google Maps and put your address in, and then you mapped all your journeys out, what you'll find is you always start at one place and you always finish there. Your home. That's where you live. What does sin look like then if it's anesthetizing us and causing us to build our cities and our spiritual homes here? Setting our focus here. Well, one thing is we'll certainly lose the urgency of the gospel in our thinking, won't we? And the things that embody our spiritual life, our desire for God's word, prayer, church life, a common mission for a sinful and fallen world, will become ever more foreign. Because after all, we're looking a little bit more for the now, not for the then. It will also appear to be far more draining and demanding than perhaps it used to be. And it will certainly cease to become a pleasure. Instead, those things are replaced more with this world's concerns and this world's pleasures. The Christian life becomes more of sort of a bolt-on to what you are. Christ will become something you try and add in. If it can fit, if he can fit, rather than being the starting point at which everything else fits. Reading the Bible, prayer, church life, it'll start getting squeezed out. Not quickly. Not everything can be like a cane or will be like a cane, but probably slowly. Suddenly those reading the Bible, it used to be every day, now it's twice a week, and now, well, you know, their life is so busy, if I can just about find an hour to squeeze anything in. And maybe the prayer meeting, you look back and you can think, years ago I was at the prayer meeting every week, and suddenly, well, it was the prayer meeting once a month, and then suddenly, well, not many other people go to the prayer meeting, so I don't think I'll be missed either. It's the anesthetic effect of sin, isn't it? It starts saying that the here and now is more important than the then. I live for here, not for Christ. Enthusiasm for Christian mission gives way to sort of spiritual sounding excuses. I remember this, I'll give you an illustration of one that I heard many years ago. It wasn't from here, so don't worry. Because God proclaims an urgent gospel, doesn't he? And we all are men whenever we hear it. And he commissions his church to go and make disciples of all nations. And if we believe it's an urgent gospel, surely that's what we would be doing. And we would desire that above everything else as a mission for our lives. Well, this is something that I was told a number of years ago by someone. We're talking about Christian mission and evangelism. And they said this, they said, well, if God desires salvation for a person, desires to bring someone to himself, he is sovereign. Salvation is a sovereign work. He will bring them through the door. You know, there's no need to go because we can't do anything. And people know where the chapel is. If you're Amy and Park, the station is there. People travel past it regularly. They know that the chapel is here. And if God moves, he'll bring them. I'd never heard good theology so abominably applied. It's a spiritual excuse, isn't it? The Bible doesn't teach that at all. But it's very good if you don't want to do anything. We also find that when we make decisions, it's the things of this world start to have an equal or greater weight. And by the way, all the things I'm saying, I struggle with myself. I don't think it's a big finger-pointing exercise. We start finding that when decisions get balanced up, and we say, well, there could be this, but it does mean I have to lose this. It does mean that I can't do X on a Saturday if I have to do that. And we start finding that on the balance of things, things start shifting more this way when before they used to shift that way. Sin's numbing us. It's paralyzing our usefulness and joy by encouraging us to make this world our home. Think of here and now as your hub, it says. Make this the gravity of your life. It numbs us to the wonderful home, joy, and relationships we have with God and the destination of heaven. I wonder if those things are true of you. So what's it like to have a family here? Relationship. What is it as a Christian for us to have a family here? A family of those you're related to, you have shared passions with, you feel things in common with, you have enjoyments and pursuits with them. What does then sin look like there if it's anesthetizing you and causing us to have families here? What does that mean? Well, if it's with people you have shared passions with and you're in common with, what happens is your distinctiveness goes, won't it? You'll start looking more and more like a non-Christian. Maybe people before would almost introduce you as a Christian, and now if people don't know you, they come up and they sort of ask if you're one, because the distinction is lost. It becomes harder to tell you apart. And also the world's passions, pursuits and interests predominantly become ours. And maybe we start feeling envious of their apparent freedoms, and we wish we could imitate them without anybody noticing. And the instructions of the Maker, the requests of the Lover, Jesus Christ, ones of healing, comfort and protection, become the rules of a tyrant. We now see them as stop, deny, prevent. And real faith starts disappearing. It starts to become mere religion. I do what is necessary, but I actually prefer being with my unconverted friends. I prefer not being with Christians. And maybe times of fellowship, times of being with other Christians, are things that you start to avoid, or they're certainly things you no longer really desire. It's sin numbing us to the wonderful relationships, community and fellowship with God and his people. Because we're a child in God's family, aren't we, if we're a Christian? We're not a child of theirs. We're a child of God's. What's it like having a glory and an honour here then? What does that look like if sin is anaesthetising us? Well, your glory and honour is what you live for, isn't it? Your glory is what you seek. So, you know, it's the thing you sort of put your hopes and set your hopes upon. What are your eyes set upon? What are you looking for? What are you striving to? What are you working to attain? Well, if sin is anaesthetizing us, it will tell us to have our glory here. Our priorities and efforts will stop being directed that way and start being directed this way. Suddenly, jobs, homes, income and lifestyle become our predominant themes, our predominant concerns. And we start seeing our own glory bound up in those things, what other people think of us bound up in those things. And those things aren't necessarily wrong, are they? There's nothing wrong with having a job or a home, obviously. But suddenly when push comes to shove and priorities are brought to bear, it's easy to balance things where you don't really have a priority, but suddenly when you have to cut something, there's a whole host of things you want to keep and you want to strive for, and then it's Christ that sort of gets pushed a little bit to the edge, and maybe a little further to the edge. Because I'd rather like a bigger house. I don't necessarily need one, but because I'd like to have a bigger house, well, I'll just go for a different church. I'll find a place where I can afford a much bigger house, then I'll just change churches. I need to take that promotion for work, so I will withdraw myself from church, and I will do my work far more and more and more, and I'll just dip in and out. And my times with Christ, they're sacrificed because, you know, I've got to get to work a lot earlier, and I'll get back later, and that's probably better, and I'll just sort of squeeze Christ in on the side. Because it's my work, my lifestyle, my money that are now my priorities. Maybe it's family. Family can be a difficult one in this area because family is a very legitimate concern. You have God-given responsibilities over your family. But does it take the ultimate position? Does your family command all your attention, interests? Is that what you really strive for? And something I found when I've wrestled with these things personally is giving. Giving in church life suddenly becomes really begrudging when you seek for things here. And you always start, and I find this, I start looking at all the giving on the basis of what I'm taking it away from rather than what I'm giving it to. And suddenly you forever look and go, well, if I give, I lose this. Rather than if I give, that is gained. You start looking at everything on how you miss out. After all, you want these things for yourself because you're seeking your glory here. Sin can so easily numb us. Can so easily numb us into paralysis and make us of no use at all. I wonder if we're on our guard as Christians. I wonder if we realise that sin doesn't just destroy, but it numbs. Well, finally, and very briefly, many of you will know that there's another Enoch in the Bible. There's Cain's city that he called Enoch. It was his dedication, his work. It's what he strived for, his dwelling on in this world. Well, the other Enoch in the Bible is in Genesis chapter 5. In fact, there's only two Enochs in the Bible. That's the second one in Genesis chapter 5. His name also means dedicated. But he's the complete opposite of Cain. He was dedicated to his walk with the Lord. Genesis 5 verse 23 says this. It says, Enoch walked with God, and he was not, for God took him. Cain succumbed to sin in the end. Cain died. His city is gone. You cannot visit it. And Cain is in hell. He succumbed to the numbing. He Enoched himself, he dedicated himself to a kingdom of the earth, and he succeeded in building a temporary city of short-lived pleasures and numbed by sin to his own destruction. Another person dedicated, Enoched himself, to the kingdom of heaven. He lived for God. He lived for an everlasting city, an everlasting home, and he dedicated himself to it. He dedicated himself to the Lord, to loving him and serving him and trusting him. And God took him to dwell there. And he's there now. He's living in the city that he sought after. And it's a city he will never be taken out of. So I wonder which city you'll live for. I wonder who you'll dedicate yourself to. Don't let sin numb you. Don't let sin numb you to destruction. If you're a non-Christian, don't go with a big smile, oh, into hell. And if you're a Christian, don't let sin numb you to paralysis. Don't be a dribbling, limp Christian that has to be stretchered all the way to heaven. Let's pray.